Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson, and joining me today is Nick English and Ollie Youngmiles from Squawkers. It's an all-Squawker podcast this
all
week.
Squawker.
All-Squawker. How
all
are you guys
hustle.
Doing? How are you doing, Nick?
I'm good. I'm very good. How are you?
I'm not bad, not bad at all. How are you, Ollie? It's been
very well.
A couple of weeks since
yeah.
the last one.
Yeah, a while. A while. I'm a looking forward to coming back on.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on.
I have a friend who listens to the Squawker Talker. I didn't know that he listened to the Squawker Talker, and I asked him, who do you like most on the Squawker Talker? And he said, Ollie Youngmiles.
I
like your friend. Favorite guest.
I like your friend a lot.
Just saying that.
Is your friend Ollie Youngmiles?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
Ollie isn't my friend.
Oh, well, a bit of a needle to the podcast. It's what we need for the energy. So this week, because as you might have heard, most of the football season is over. We've just got the cup finals to come. It's going to be a bit of a Q&A special. So I've asked Twitter, as usual, for all your questions. And we're also going to cover some of the questions we didn't have time for in previous episodes as well. So some big philosophical as well.
Will
pointers.
Smith would be happy.
He would be.
There's so many questions on this agenda, dude.
And we're going to get through all of them. It's going to be beautiful. But before we do, as you might have heard, Big Sam has left the building. He says he's done, really, with football. It sounds like he's retired. Although we'll see how that goes come November time when some squad is struggling at the bottom of the Premier League. Yeah. What do you make of it, Ollie?
No, exactly what you said. I mean, he's still fairly young. I mean, he looks weathered,
he's a young
but
man.
He's still fairly young. And I think if there is a job and a lot of cash to go with it in, say, January, I think he might jump at the chance to take it. Mm. It is a bit of a bizarre one. I think Palace have seemed to just be getting through managers a lot at the moment. And I don't know if there's an issue with the chairman there, because Tony Pulis said exactly the same thing a couple of years ago. So it's all a bit weird, especially with Zaha signing a contract this week as well. Seems a bit weird timing, but yeah, we'll see. We'll have to cope without Big Sam next year.
We will have to cope. Well, we might have to
we
cope.
Say we that
might.
Every year.
Well, some of us are admirers of the Big Sam's work. The Big Sam. I think Pep Guardiola might be one of them in his press conference at the start of the season. He did give him the definite article,
yeah.
The Big Sam. Just on that point of Crystal Palace, we often talk about the absence of directors of football in English football. Could this be a case of traditional British managers kind of bouncing off Steve Parrish as this kind of quite influential figure in the boardroom, linking the owners with the management?
Yeah, Crystal Palace are definitely a club still running very much an old school way.
But no, what I'm saying is maybe they're not, because Steve Parrish, this guy, he's got much more influence on how things are going. He's surely the guy who sorted out the Zaha deal, isn't he? So
yeah, potentially. I mean, Big Sam, despite, you know, being quite burly and northern, is actually quite a modern manager, which is why I kind of think that he might go to the MLS. I do think that would be a perfect fit for him. Big money, lots of sun.
Big money for Big Sam.
Big money for Big Sam.
Big Sam.
A league which, you know, is very physical, where systems are easily implemented. The players are very disciplined. They come out of, basically, most of them come out of college, like, just born to play football. They're not, you know, difficult to manage. He could do some really interesting things out in the MLS.
But would you want to go over there? It seems
It's a great lifestyle. I can see him over there. I don't see what he probably thinks, like, well, I got the England job and then that all went really wrong. I'm not going to get a top six job. I'm not, like, what am I doing in the UK? He might get another job and get a packet of money, but he's probably okay cash wise.
But it's from his statement, it sounds like it actually wasn't a confrontation with the owners so much. It was more a case of England didn't go I wanted to. I wanted one job to clear my name and then go out on top, which he kind of has done. I mean, he's got nothing left to prove in football, really, does he?
I mean, especially at Palace as well, for a while, it looked like things weren't going to go the way that we expected. When he usually takes a job like that, he'll keep a team up. But the first couple of months, really, at Palace, he was struggling to get his ideas across. As usual, he smashed it in the transfer window, brought really well, and kept them up. And then I think, as you said, after the whole England debacle, he's ended on a high. If this is the, you know, the sort of end of his managerial career.
Any final thoughts on Big Sam?
He's very, very good manager. Very good manager. It's a shame it didn't work out with the England job. I think he would have done a very decent job. But I think he's a very good manager. Probably underrated. Brought a lot of innovation to the game. And
weirdly enough, got that innovation from America as well when he was over there with Tampa Bay Rowdies. Got some. So basically, a lot of the kind of stats and stuff that he did came from NFL. So
exactly.
Maybe he should go back to America. It would be a nice, like, completion of the narrative.
And he laughed at Chico Flores, which was hilarious.
Wasn't it?
Which was hilarious.
Good times. Good times with Big Sam.
Yeah, good memories.
Good times with Big Sam. Moving on now to the Europa League final, which you may have also heard happen this week. Ajax lost 2-0 to Manchester United in Stockholm. Worthy winners for you, Ollie?
Definitely. I think you've got to give them credit. You know, before the tournament started, they were picked out as the big favourites to win it. And I mean, there's about 200 teams in that competition, and they've ended up winning it. So you've got to say well done to them. And the final was pretty much a procession. Obviously, Pogba's goal had more than a hint of luck about it, but they did a very professional job. Mm. It was classic Mourinho final sort of tactics, and they got the job done, and they've qualified for the Champions League. So as far as they're concerned, it's, you know, it's a great campaign for them.
There was a bit of disappointment over how the final went, but. Mm. Was it a case of United didn't let Ajax play? It wasn't a case of Ajax didn't turn up. United were just better. Maybe not spectacularly good, but they just held them off.
I think it was a bit of two things. It was United turning up and doing the job and Mourinho just drumming into them the tactics, and also Ajax being slightly overawed by the whole thing, which was always going to be a slight worry, considering how young their team is. They've shown, even in this run where they've been really exciting going forward, they have shown that they're vulnerable as well. Mm. And I think they just sort of froze in the occasion. But United got the job done. They deserve to win.
Ajax complained after the game that only one side was interested in playing football in this match. They called United a long ball team. Mm-hmm. Obviously, United did stick Fellaini on the pitch, and they kind of used him to bypass Ajax's pressing.
Who was amazing, by the way.
He was very, very good. But did you find that whole thing a case of whining or fair points from Ajax?
Of course it is. Of course, it is whining. Like, you know, Mourinho set up United to be like, oh, go on then, you're really good apparently, why don't you break us down? Oh, look at that, you can't. Mm. Like,
it was almost a show of respect, really, that he went to those lengths
massively. He obviously, like, this is the classic thing about Mourinho, he does his homework. There's no opponent too crap for him to not be like, do you know what, you're really good with the ball, I'm gonna respect you with it. That's why he's the opposite of us and Wenger in many ways, who's just like, we'll play whatever way I think we should play. Mourinho's like, well, tell you what, this team's obviously gotten here by scoring goals, I want to stop them scoring goals. And yeah, they got lucky with a goal, but they were definitely the team on top. They started really, really quick. They started excellently, and then they sort of just held off, and what Ajax recovered from that shock, and then they just blocked the options out wide, forced Ajax to pass through the middle. It didn't work. Fellaini was excellent. Pogba was unreal in that first half, by the way. Mm. That was one of the best.
They were literally bouncing off him, Valencia, Fellaini, bouncing off them.
Yunus versus Valencia was such a mismatch. It was so obvious tactically. I know he deserved to start, but Valencia versus Yunus was a terrible idea. Mm. Valencia at one point just nudged him off, and he almost flew over the advertising boards. So it was a joke.
And we've had a question actually on Pogba from a Stats and Swear Words on Twitter. He says, has Pogba really been as bad as the media would have us believe?
I mean, of course not. Like, and I don't know if it's any case of like the media making us believe anymore. It's 14-year-olds on Twitter who are trying to make us believe that Pogba's been that bad.
Don't go in on our audience, Nick.
Look at Pogba. Look at United this season with and without Pogba, and you'll know straight away how important he is to the team. He's become the heartbeat of it. He's 24, I believe. 24? Yeah. He's 24.
Only just
24. He's the sort of player in terms of physique and ability that peaks much later than like a young winger or a you know, exciting young striker. He's already dominating games in the Premier League despite only playing one season there. And coming from Serie A to the Premier League is an incredibly rare move, by the way. Midfield play in Serie A is a lot different than it is in the Premier League. And already he looks like next season he's going to be unbelievable. We said it so many times on the pod this year that, you know, he's actually been a lot better than what the stats suggest. He could have had so many more assists. He's been brilliant at times. And in the first half of that Europa League final, like, he just did an absolute job of them. They as you said, they were bouncing off him. They couldn't get near him.
Just looking at the stats, how many goals do you think he would have if United could finish? If you look at his numbers, he's created so many chances. I mean, I think only De Bruyne has actually attempted more. Sorry, no, he's only completed more free balls than Pogba. United haven't been able to hit a barn door, have they, really?
Yeah, that's been their problem all season. They scored fewer goals than Bournemouth, which sort of tells you everything you need to know. Obviously, Bournemouth are great and everything, but...
Does that mean Harry Arter's more world-class than Paul Pogba? So.
Well, maybe. Conversation for another day.
Of course it does.
But yeah, no, Pogba... I sort of agree with Nick on this. I think it's the same old people sort of digging Pogba out. Just, you know, I don't think they're watching the games that he's playing in, really, because...
I mean, it took just to jump in, because I know you admire of him, it took a while for people to really get Moussa Dembele as well, didn't it, for similar reasons?
Yeah, definitely. But I think Pogba... The encouraging thing about him, when you compare him to Dembele, for instance, Dembele only started to get that consistency in his game at sort of 28. And Pogba is doing that, in my opinion, at 24 for United. And I think another thing to consider for Pogba as well, when he was at Juve, he wasn't really the man pulling the strings. You think of that team that got to the Champions League final. It was Vidal and Pirlo, really, that was the stars of that midfield. He was sort of, you know, given
the
freedom.
Era of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And you could rely on the experience of Marquisio as well.
Yeah,
he was a huge asset in that midfield.
And he's come to United and he's suddenly the one expected to dictate the play and do all that. So it's a sort of a positional change for him as well. But I think as well, in the big games, he's generally turned up. The Celta Vigo game, when he went on that mad run, beating about six players and just generally dominated that game. And then in the final as well, he turned up. So I think he's only going to get better next season. I think he's had a really good season, actually. He hasn't got the goals and assists, but I don't know if he really needs to, because he's the player that links everything together for United.
Mm-hmm. I think, as Nick said, he's the heartbeat. What I find interesting with Pogba is it seems like every single season he's had as a professional footballer, there's been some big criticism saying, oh, you can't do that. Mm. And pretty much every single season, he's then at the end gone, I have done it now. He hasn't quite got the goals and assists, but I wouldn't bet against him going on a bit of a Lampard-esque run at some point in his career.
Look at Zidane's career figures.
No, I get all that. I'm not saying he needs to do it to prove his value. Yeah, what I'm saying is, you look at him in Serie A, and at first people say, oh, he's a young guy, he can't control the ball. And he was like, oh, no, actually, I'm going to just trap the ball all the time, it's going to be fine. People said he couldn't run games, he proved he could run games. People said he couldn't be a playmaker. In his last season in Serie A, he was top for the assists with Pjanic. So not what I'm saying is that maybe under Mourinho as well, a guy who can appreciate the worth in having a powerful, very talented footballer in attacking spaces, maybe we will see him do the reductive goal scoring that he needs to prove to some people. Yeah.
I think another thing with Pogba is just his sort of larger than life personality and his transfer fee are sort of two things that people, like joyless people, want to just pick on him for.
Go on.
Do you know what I mean?
Go
like,
on.
Like, if Pogba was sort of more understated, then I think, you know, he wouldn't attract as much criticism as he does.
But if he was understated, would he have been sold for 89 million?
No, of course not. That personality and that brand.
Yeah, there's the whole marketing thing behind it. But like, realistically, like what you mentioned, like Mourinho's a great manager for him because he can, you know, sort of coach him in the way he coached Lampard to be that sort of extra goal scorer for Chelsea.
Interesting stuff to see in the years ahead. Actually, next year, as you say, after a year in English football, it'll be interesting to see how he takes it on in his second year. I've had another question on United. Stephen Roberts asks, with better defensive individuals recruited in the summer, is Mourinho then able to improve United's attacking play?
No.
Why not?
Because United have all the tools at their disposal. I mean, there's a lot of talk of, oh God, United's awful defence, but it's really not that bad. I mean, it's top four quality, I think. Just
need to stay fit.
Just need to stay fit, and also their finishing was atrocious at some points this season. It's all to do with Mourinho's outlook, isn't it? And how he approaches games, you know, and that's the key element of it. Improving, Mourinho isn't the guy who's going to come in and transform United's attacking play through placing an emphasis on combinations. You know, like a great example of Mourinho not wanting to be ambitious in that respect is the benching of Luke Shaw. The reason he's benching Luke Shaw is like, I only want one fullback that really rampages forward in Valencia, which is fine. Like, it's fine. But, you know, the fact that you only have one attacking fullback suggests that, and three up front suggests that you're not being very adventurous. And you've got three midfielders, not one of them is really a 10, unless sometimes he plays Juan Mata. So I don't think he's really going to be he's the coach that's going to win United trophies, not the coach that's going to get them back to the glory days of scoring 100 goals a season.
I think.
Do you hear that, Ollie?
Yeah, I would. I think they will sign a centre back. I think they do need one. Eric Bailly is an absolute monster. He's top class player in the making. I saw him at Spurs a couple of weeks ago playing right back, and he looks like a great right back as well.
So good on the ball as well.
Yeah, he's got everything, I think. But they need someone else. But I mean, even considering that they haven't had a sort of settled first choice defensive unit, they've had the second best defensive record in the league. They've only conceded 29 goals, which is four fewer than Chelsea. So if they get another centre back in, that gives them such a solid base, and then hopefully then their attacking players will
Like the rule sort of Johan Cruyff actually. You either win the league by scoring over 90 goals or conceding under 20. You know, and Mourinho's approach to it is definitely concede under 20. He's got top four defence right now. He's gonna, I agree with Ollie, he's gonna want to like a top two or the best defence in the league. That's what he wants.
Just to go back to Stephen's question, I kind of think we've missed the spirit of it slightly, because I think he was asking not so much is the defence bad, more that if he gets like a solid defensive base, will he almost allow more freedom to the attackers in that case? If he can lock down.
If you look at United's supposed transfer targets, they're basically going for players that can create a goal out of nothing.
Mm.
I think what Mourinho is going to do is set up his team to be very, very difficult to break down defensively and then hope that one of his attacking players can just score a goal. That's going to be, you know, their tactics next season. I don't think there'll be a set attacking style as such.
Mm.
It'll be focused on building on a strong defence and then hoping Griezmann or Pogba or Rashford gets a goal out of nothing, which obviously they can do.
Because to be fair, when you're on a counter-attack, you can't really coach that anyway, because it's almost like playing five-a-side, isn't it? If you've got three guys running on goal, it's just about playing football. It's just about getting forward, finding your teammate and just making those chances count.
Yeah, definitely.
So maybe that's what we're looking for. Last question on this. Mark Thompson asks, if you could sell one Man United centre-back in the summer, who would it be?
Probably Phil Jones.
Yeah?
Yeah, because... So, Smalling is the backup to Bailly, right? And Marcos Rojo is the sort of the other guy. He's sort of like, you can see as the other, or the one who's going to be replaced, effectively. You need a partner for Bailly. And then that sort of leaves Rojo, who's a multi-purpose centre-back, who's quite useful to have. And you just want to have Daily Blind in the squad, because he's that sort of player that, if you have like a really annoying like League Cup game or something against a team that's really clever and wily, he's the sort of player that's just going to shut that down. And also he's got probably the best set piece delivery in the league. Like, his corners are incredible. I don't see where Phil Jones fits in with any of it. He's not really defensive enough. He's not really that good on the ball. He's not amazing in the air. He just seems to be like, he seems to be a bit of 6 or 7 out of 10 at everything. And he's just, Phil Jones smacks of Stoke. He reeks of Stoke. Oof. He reeks of a partnership with Ryan Shawcross that's going to be settled for 5 years, and he's going to do really, really well there. I don't see how. You know, if like the rumours are like Michael Keane's going to come in, Michael Keane and Eric Bailly, that makes perfect sense. Mm. I don't see how Phil Jones fits in with any of those other players.
Ollie, yeah. Do you agree with that?
I actually would, yeah. There was a time in the season where Jones was playing really well when he was alongside Rojo, and it looked like Mourinho had finally been the man to get the best out of him, and he's just... And then injuries happened again. Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting that neither of you have actually said Smalling, because I know he's a very... After how impressive he was under Van Gaal, a few people have found him quite a divisive figure in amongst United fans.
I think that's the thing, though. I mean, Jones and Smalling basically came in at the same time. And you'd look at Jones and you wouldn't say he's had one full season where he's been consistently good throughout, whereas Smalling at least has that behind him. And Smalling is a leader as well. Yeah. You know, he wore the armband a lot last season, whereas Jones is still just a bit of a headless chicken at the back. Sorry,
go on.
Yeah, no, sorry. Just one other thing on the defenders. I'd like to see Tuan Zabi maybe get a loan move next year to a promoted team, perhaps, maybe Newcastle. Because he's looked really good at the Emirates. I thought he was excellent.
Yeah.
Good in midfield as well in the final game of the season. Yeah.
So,
good
player. If they've got five centre-backs.
Osu-Mensah as well, who can play for
Ryan. Roshan position. Williams as well coming up.
Yeah.
Loads of players.
Yeah, they've got great players. They don't need Phil Jones. He's he's never going to hit his peak now, is he? And you keep Chris Smalling, I think, because he's ridiculously athletic. He's quick and he's strong and he's really good in the air.
He's really tall as well, which I know is a daft thing to say, but Phil Jones is, what, 5'10"?
Yeah,
that can count against you
Phil
as well.
Phil Jones is massive. I don't think, I'd sell Jones over Smalling, because Smalling's just, you can sit him back and he'll just win every header.
Mm.
There you go. I'm going to move on now to the five clubs in the Champions League, because as United did win the Europa League, they're now almost like the bonus round of English football. Mm. We've got five teams in the Champions League for next year. But before we do, Thomas Shanahan has asked another question, and this is kind of related to Spurs, to Arsenal, to United. What counts as a good season in all competitions these days, Nick?
This is a really weird question, because it's not the same in any other league in Europe. And the reason why that is Arsene Wenger, who somehow, like, he's set the bar so high for what counts as a good season, which is basically like, you know, but that top four status has now become such a cult term in the UK because of Champions League.
Mm.
And so the top four status is like sort of, you know...
If you're outside of it, you're in crisis.
If you're outside of it, you're in crisis. And he's sort of made that the thing, right? Because he did it for so many years. Spurs have had a great season, but they're walking away with zero silverware.
They're in the club, but they haven't actually got a drink, have they?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas United have got a League Cup and Europa League, and they've been worse pretty much all season.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I know Spurs had a terrible run in Europe, but, you know, that's really odd. Man City, have they had a better season than United? A lot of City fans would say yes, you know, despite everything, because it looks like they're on a path. I think there's so many ways you can argue it that nobody's really sure anymore. The only team that's unequivocally had the best season is Chelsea, because they're on for a league and cup double. The standards are so high now, everyone's you know, it's never enough just to, like Arsenal fans a couple of years ago won back-to-back FA Cups. Oh, it's not a good season.
Well, the FA, that's the thing, the FA Cup's lost its luster as well, to some extent.
Well, so. Has it? Like, you know, has it necessarily?
But you think back to the days of even like, okay, this is going back a long way. I wasn't alive for it, but Brian Clough never won the FA Cup. It was something he was really gutted about. Liverpool, how many times were they in the FA Cup final in like the 30s and the rest of it? Until they finally won it, it was like a real kind of, you know, hex over them for a while. You don't really... It's just another cup now, isn't it, really?
Yeah, the standards have completely changed, basically. And it's all relative. Mm. For Spurs, like, having a good season was, for a long time, coming above Arsenal or getting Champions League football. Now, a good season for them is going to be winning the league. You know, that's where the bar is. For Wenger, it's, you know, he has to win the title. For Man United, it's winning the title. For Guardiola, it's winning the title. For Chelsea now, it's winning the title. Like, it's just absurd. Like, and it's not... Like, all the football fans' expectations are a bit unrealistic, in my opinion.
Any thoughts on that, Ollie?
Yeah, I agree with Nick, really. I think the race for the top four in the Premier League now is so intense that you've got six very good teams battling it out. Whoever secures those top four spots, I think you'd have to say, have done, maybe not had a good season, but they've had an okay season. I mean, it's so intense to get in those spots. But yeah, I mean, it's difficult. United finished out of that, and you'd still say they've had a good season because they've won two trophies.
Mm-hmm. So, what about Liverpool? The Liverpool fans were saying they had a great season.
Yeah, you know? And I mean, I guess you look at their lack of depth, which we're going to get onto very shortly. Yeah. You kind of have to argue they did. They just about made it over the line, but imagine what they can do with Champions League football. Which brings us on to our next question from Mizgan, who says, with five English teams in the Champions League now, is it time to have English dominance back in Europe's elite, especially with the big name managers that are now at our clubs?
About time.
It's about time.
It's about time. We've declared Article 50.
Oh, dear.
We've unleashed hell.
Are you saying they're going to take back control of the Champions League?
Yeah, basically. Oh, yeah, Nick. We've decided we're taking back control of Europe via... No, of course not.
Glad you didn't go out too long. That was
I mean, so this season, obviously not, but you look at what a lot of the teams are doing. So Chelsea are going to strengthen the summer. Man City already going, you can tell.
Bernardo Silva.
They've already, seems like they've already signed Bernardo Silva. They've gotten rid of four squad players.
About five, actually, if you include Willy Caballero as well.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot about Caballero. They're getting rid of Edward, and they've got a lot of money to spend, so that's going to be huge. Man United have limitless amounts of money. Arsenal, well, they're in the Europa League.
not to be specific, but we are only talking about the Champions League.
No, I know. Sorry. It's just such an assumption on my part. Spurs, I mean, really tough time in the Champions League last time.
Yeah, they're the one out of this five that you look at and go, if anyone's going to let the side down when it comes to Europe, it's probably them, isn't
it? Well, squad depth. I mean, Liverpool as well. Squad depth is a real issue for them, for Spurs and Liverpool. But I do think Chelsea, Man United, Man City... Like, one of them three, I do think one of them will get to the semi-finals or final. I think they're going to be really, really good next season. They've all three of them got excellent coaches and a lot of money and already good squads and star players in all of their lineups.
This just sounds like the usual English assumption, though, isn't it? Oh, we've got five teams in, that's quantity. We've spent loads of money, so that's quality. It doesn't really work that way, does it?
No, but I think if you look beyond... the finalists this season, Barcelona are sort of in a bit of a transitional period. Bayern Munich as well, losing Lahm and Alonso. Those four clubs have basically dominated it for the last 3 or 4 years. And you'd only really say Real Madrid and Juventus are set to go again as they are next season. So there is a little bit of... Monaco showed as well. They came out of nowhere, reached the semis. I think it is about time an English club got that far in the competition. I mean, this year was frankly just embarrassing.
Coaching has a huge part to play in it as well. Like, you know, 2 years ago it was Moyes, Pellegrini, you know, it was a Mourinho side that was all over the place, you know, and Arsene Wenger's Arsenal, who are, you know, last 16 fodder. So I think coaching has a huge part. Guardiola, Klopp, Conte and Mourinho, very different. Pochettino as well, he's an excellent coach. Yeah, hopefully you can figure out in Europe. That's a very different proposition for other clubs.
It makes you wonder, having what Ollie's just said there, this idea that other sides in Europe are maybe weakening at the moment or potentially just through the cycles of play. Do you think there's anything in the idea that when the Premier League was dominant in the mid to late 2000s, that kind of came after a similar period where the big teams kind of lost a bit of their momentum? Again, Porto beat Monaco in the Champions League final and a similar kind of, you know, outsiders coming in. Does English football need the rest of Europe to be weak in order for it to actually dominate?
No, Man United got to the final and got beaten soundly by Pep Guardiola's Barcelona twice. You know, there's no shame in losing to that team.
But what I'm saying is at that point, that's when the rest of Europe seemed to get their act together. Bayern sorted themselves out, Real Madrid sorted themselves out, Juventus started doing good things as well.
I think at the time, though, Premier League clubs were just so good. That top four that there was every single year were just so well set up to play in Europe. Mm. Whereas now it's been, I think the Premier League has become more competitive as well, and that sort of drained the teams in the Champions League a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's been far too long for the Premier League clubs to be sort of struggling in Europe. And I think, am I right in saying if we struggle again this year, then we could lose a place, perhaps?
I'm not so sure, because United got to the Europa League final and won. True, I think that's kind of been a bit of a Brucey bonus to kind of send us through.
Love a Brucey bonus.
Because obviously Spain as well have been winning that, which has been helping their thing as well, massively.
I'm quite interested to see how Conte approaches it, because when he was at Juventus, he didn't really pull up any trees in Europe. And he'll head into this competition next season, you know, with the Premier League title secure. He's got a bit of leeway, whereas Guardiola has to sort of go on two fronts. Pochettino has got the pressure of taking Tottenham further than he did last year. Liverpool have to qualify for it first. So Chelsea have got a little bit of leeway, and I think Conte sort of needs to show what he can do in Europe next year.
Mm-hmm. Got another question through from Massimo Dariani, who says, what is the ideal import-export number of players to allow a team to click from the start? I think he's speaking specifically about Manchester City here, given that they've already let five go. Yeah. And by the sounds of it, there's going to be quite a few coming in. We often talk about the difficulties of having a true overhaul, because it can really destabilise your squad. Do you think there is like a magic number or a magic ratio of players it's wise to bring in and maybe not so wise for more players coming in?
There probably is. I mean, it just all relates back to one of the most underrated aspects of management, which is how do you handle the group dynamics of your team? You know, you need a certain number of personalities. We've seen players stay way beyond their sell-by date at clubs, like Pablo Zabaleta, because they're so influential in the dressing room. And sometimes what a manager will do is they'll bring in a couple of new faces and see how the group responds to that, see if there's any new leaders that emerge. Like, okay, I've got some new leaders, or the leadership is more distributed. Mm. I'll let this guy move on. Chelsea have got that problem, like, right now, is Conte's probably been... he's handled that very, very well. He's taken John Terry out of the playing picture. Off the field, he remains a huge influence at Chelsea, has done all season. But what's probably happened in the meantime is that players like David Luiz, who weren't previously allowed to lead from centre-back, have emerged as leaders. Gary Cahill as well. You know, there's players across the pitch becoming more outspoken leaders. So it's just managing the individual group. I don't think there's a magical number. It all depends on the group dynamics and making sure nobody falls out.
Essentially, it's a squad game, isn't it? I mean, you know, you can sign 10 players, but if only two or three of them are guaranteed to start, then, you know, it sort of changes the whole answer to that question. I think ideally you don't really want to be getting more than three players. Chelsea, I think, bought four players, but three slotted into that first team and made a huge difference. And the thing that I find quite interesting about this Man City deal with Bernardo Silva, if City went into next season with the attack they've got now, no one would bat an eyelid, because they've got so much quality there. But you look at the other end, they need to sign three or four defenders, which is going to take time to sort of mould that. So I find it interesting that they've gone straight out and bought another attacking player when they've got so much to do at the back. I mean, there's going to be a big turnover of players in that position.
I mean, Pep's got like history for doing this. Bayern Munich, he brought in a Thiago Alcantara when they already had the most overstocked midfield in Europe, and then added Philipp Lahm in there as defence midfielder as well. So
that's the one thing that I'd worry slightly about City, is that they had a big summer last year when they brought in a whole team of players pretty much, and they're going to do the same this summer, and he needs to win something next year. So it's all about marrying that squad and getting the signings in quickly so they gel quicker and can go straight from the start of the season. But you look at Tottenham as well, actually, they bought four players, but only one of them made a difference in Wanyama. And that team developed massively this season compared to last. You know, they got 13 points more in the Premier League, I think. And that showed, you know, that continuity, I think, showed, because that group had been together the season before. And they just improved over the next season. And I don't think Pochettino will make too many this year either.
Well, on that point, Game of Thrones asks, who do Tottenham need to bring in to win the title?
I think the general consensus is that they need to bring in a pacey winger that can stretch the play and can maximise the dimensions of the huge Wembley pitch.
Yep.
Basically the player that Sissoko was meant to be.
And Wilfred Zaha was meant to be until he signed his deal at Palace. Yeah.
And on that, I would say probably the ideal person for that would be Felipe Anderson at Lazio. I mean, you look at his stats and he is literally just ready-made for Poch.
Yeah, most, he will cost tackles and most take-ons.
Exactly.
What a ridiculous mix of numbers.
He'll cost an absolute packet.
That is the problem.
But at least one Sissoko. That's how much he'll cost.
Yeah. It depends whether Pochettino's feeling brave enough to really go all out. I doubt it. I think Pochettino seems quite conservative in transfer market. Sissoko.
I think that's basically been put on him, though. More so from Levy in the stadium. But I think if Spurs manage to offload the players that they don't need and maybe Walker for, 35, 40 million to City, if that happens, then suddenly there's a bit more leeway. And I think as well, the last two summers, they'll need to learn from that because they've taken gambles that haven't paid off. And if you add those gambles up, as much money as going out and buying a proven quality player. So
I'd like to see Tottenham strengthen too. It's clear that their squad is an issue. They need a young deputy centre back
alongside to replace Wimmer.
Well, Veltman's linked, isn't he? He can play right back and centre
back. That would make sense.
That would be an excellent addition for Spurs. I think he'd cost them quite a bit though. They need to identify talent like they've done with Harry Winks in midfield. They need an understudy there. The same in attack. But I'd also like to see them have one more experienced name/leader in there. Maybe not someone who's getting a lot of game time, but maybe a midfielder or a fullback of some sort. Someone really, really, someone like Pablo Zabaleta would have been quite useful. Actually, I don't know if you'd gotten a lot of game time, but someone who's been there, done that, won a lot of things, can like nurture the young kids, help Pochettino. You're staring at me like you want to say something.
Remember the name.
Wayne Rooney. Never Wayne Rooney. I think actually, I was talking about this with Ollie a couple of weeks ago. I think Spurs should go all in on trying to get Michael Carrick back. He'd be absolutely brilliant back at Spurs right now. Man United don't really need him anymore. He'd be a lot of wages, but probably a low transfer fee. He's not going to run out of seasons anytime soon.
I don't think Mourinho's going to let him go, by the sounds of it, because they have offered him a new deal, haven't they? So.
Yeah, maybe Michael Carrick doesn't leave, but that's why I think if Spurs went big and said, like, 15 million for Michael Carrick, we'll just buy him back for the same price we sold him for. that could make a huge difference.
That sounds like Jermaine Defoe money.
In those games, those key slip-ups that Spurs had this season, bringing on someone like Michael Carrick could make all the difference, as opposed to Wanyama, who's sometimes a bit of a headless chicken, Moussa Dembele, who can be a bit ill-disciplined and gets tired in the last 15 minutes. Someone like Michael Carrick could have made a huge difference to their title challenge.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm quite interested to see if anything happens with this Ross Barkley link, because I think it'd be really fascinating to see how Pochettino would approach coaching him.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at him, if he came in, I could sort of see Pochettino going to him, right, I'm going to turn you into Moussa Dembele part two, because you look at him, they are sort of similar in styles. You know, Dembele is a more elegant dribbler of the ball, but Barkley is very, very good when he gets going with the ball at his feet. I just think he needs the sort of manager that can coach him, coach him and tell him what to do. Yeah. You know, that Poch has a proven track record with working with young English talent, and I think it'd be really interesting to see what he'd do with Barkley.
And we've talked in the past the fact that Moussa Dembele began as a striker in the Netherlands, came to England, Mark Hughes played him as an attacking mid, and he's kind of moved back from there, hasn't he? So maybe that could be the way forward for Ross Barkley. Another question from Chris Etchingham off Twitter, who asks, does a Premier League team have an Icardi-shaped hole in its front line? Please say yes.
Yes. Yes, Chris. Yes. No, it was interesting because I read the agenda and I was thinking, as soon as I saw the name Mauro Icardi, I just went Arsenal.
Yeah, 100%. Completely agree.
Arsenal.
He would be perfect for Arsenal.
Perfect. You look at what Danny Welbeck offers Arsenal, you think, God, if they had a slightly better, more predatory finisher version of Danny Welbeck, because Danny Welbeck's great. Like, I love watching him play, but he's not quite got the nous in and around the penalty area to score 20 goals a season. Mauro Icardi would be unbelievable at Arsenal.
You could see him in an Arsenal shirt as well. Yeah. He's got that Arsenal look about him.
He's good in the air as well.
Maybe one saving grace for Arsenal is the fact that Inter are in Europa League as well. So maybe that won't dissuade him from going somewhere.
They'd
like
never
that.
Pay the money. He'd cost so much money. He'd be £60 million circa. Unless, well, they're going to get some money. They might get some money from Bellerin and Sanchez, so they might want to invest in Icardi. That would be an unbelievable purchase from Wenger. That would be two huge fingers up at a lot of people. And also, it works in a 4-4-2 as well with Giroud and Icardi. That works perfectly.
You could maybe see him at Chelsea as well as a Costa replacement.
I know a lot of Chelsea fans are actually very keen on that idea.
Yeah, strange that he hasn't really been linked that much. It seems like Lukaku is going to be the one they go for, but I'd be more inclined to go with Icardi. I think he's more complete than Lukaku is. And I think he'd sort of fit that 4-3-4-3 system they've got as well. So
great personality as well, and he's been banging in goals for what's been a really dour side for quite some time. Under Mancini, my God, they were poor to watch, and he was banging goals in. So, yeah.
This might bring us on to Liverpool now. But Mr. Walker Porter, great name, asks...
first name Kyle.
It should be. Out of the top six, who needs to utilise the transfer window the most?
Spurs.
Not Liverpool?
No.
Ooh. Interesting. No.
I think the way Jurgen Klopp plays, he's you can already tell he's identified kids that are going to make the step up and going to be useful for him in certain situations. You can tell Klopp is very close to having his favoured first 11. He really trusts his players. I think they need someone other. They need to sort the striker situation, whether it's reminding Divock Origi that he's a footballer and not just a 100-metre sprinter, or finding another yard of pace in Daniel Sturridge, who looks to have like slacked massively, or getting Firmino to stop dropping deep. Whatever it is, sort out the striker situation. But the rest of that team, you look at it, they're like that first 11 has caused a lot of team a lot of problems. It's so system based with Klopp that he just needs to bring in a couple of players. Spurs have a lot to do with the squad depth. They have a lot to do. When there's an injury, they're screwed.
I'd probably say that's more a case of Liverpool for me. Yeah. I mean, Spurs, I think if you lose Potter's shown actually this season, he's got a different formation he can switch to. He's got a few players come in. Son was great when he had to come in. Liverpool, he can maybe lose one of Lallana, Coutinho, Mane or Firmino, but if he loses...
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That's a long list of players.
No, but if he loses like two at the same time, they it's not like they amble forward, they literally cease to play. And when you lose Henderson as well, he's hugely important, but his fitness issues...
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Tottenham actually had a lot of injuries this season that sort of people forget about, and they kind of just carried on. People came in and sort of did the job. People like Trippier and Ben Davis improved hugely. Harry Winks came out of nowhere and did well. Wanyama, obviously. I don't think Spurs' squad is as weak as Nick's suggesting. And I think Liverpool actually do need to put some meat on that squad they've got a very good bare 11. But I think beyond that, when they lost Mane, they looked completely different side. Coutinho as well. I think they need four or five players, especially as well. Klopp signed four players in three windows at Liverpool. He hasn't done much business, really. The players he has signed have generally done well.
He's always like that. He likes to work with the players that he's got. And also, I think the Mane injury was overstated, because what happened after the Mane injury is they played loads of bottom half sides, and they've been struggling against them all season with or without Mane. Mane's not a player who's going to break them down. So I think that was overstated. The key thing for Liverpool, and this might happen next season from my point of view, is getting consistency out of Philippe Coutinho. If they can get him to play more than 3 months a season, they could be title challengers, because he is unbelievable. On his day, he's unbelievable.
I almost feel sorry for him a little bit, though, because he did seem to get it. And then the injury came. It wasn't a case of he dropped off.
It's not his fault. He's young. He's young. Yeah. It comes with age. Like it's a really difficult position to play.
Would you keep playing him on the wing though? Because we saw last few weeks.
Play him anywhere. Play him anywhere. He's amazing.
That left centre midfield role, I think, is his best. Yeah. I think the last few weeks of the season, that West Ham game. Sure, West Ham were an absolute shambles, but he absolutely dictated the play, and he's so good at carrying the ball. And when he's on form in the final third, he's devastating as well.
So would you try and find like a left-sided version of Mane to kind of free him up in a more central role then?
I don't know, because I quite like seeing Lallana and Coutinho sort of rotating in that role. But I think I agree with Nick, they need a striker that Klopp's going to trust. And I mean, Firmino, I really like as a player, but he's a second striker. I wouldn't say he's a number nine. But he's not clinical enough.
Isn't that the charm of his system, though, in that it's almost like what Aguero has been doing recently with City, where he drops back and he creates a space for others to come into.
But Liverpool need a plan B. You know, all season they've relied on plan A, and when it hasn't worked, they haven't had anything to sort of change it up. And also, next season they're going to have so many more games that, you know, they're going to have to utilise their squad a bit better. But I think going back to the question, I think City still are the ones that need to utilise it the most, because they've got.
Yeah, sorry. I changed my answer to City. Sorry.
Cheers. I mean, you look at their squad now after this sort of exodus that happened yesterday. They've got four defenders that were in their first team squad still at the club. One of them is Kompany, who will play 10 games a season. One of them's John Stones, who hasn't improved. One of them's Otamendi, who's a bit of a headless chicken. And one's Kolarov. So, I mean, they need to do a lot this summer. They need five or six players, I think.
Well, we're going to move on now to two of the sides listed in that little list we did there. In the FA Cup final this year, they're going to be contesting this hallowed trophy, the oldest trophy in club football, as we're always told. Ceremonial at Wembley. It's going to be the battle of the 3-4-2-1s. How do they differ for each manager and where are their strengths? Ollie.
Yeah, Ollie.
It's a tough one. I have to say, I'm not sure I've watched Arsenal enough in this system. I was impressed with them in the semi-final when they played it, because initially when Wenger did it, I sort of thought, he's just copying everyone. Like, it doesn't really
fit. It looked that way against Middlesbrough.
Yeah, and I thought it didn't really. I thought it didn't really fit their players. But then you look at Ozil. I think he sort of kind of got back to his best form playing in that system. They do play it in a similar way, and I think you're right in saying that it's a 3-4-2-1 because Sanchez and Ozil tuck in, and Hazard and Pedro tuck in. It's not a 3-4-3. So if they do go with that, it'll be interesting to see how they cancel each other out and. And what kind of styles they play. I think Chelsea are a bit more direct than Arsenal are.
Mm. Yeah, to me, it seems like Arsenal use their extra man at the back to almost sit back. They're much happier to defend.
Yeah, it's quite clear that Wenger brought in the system just to stop leaking goals. It was after that Crystal Palace match where they lost 3-0, and he just looked at it and just thought, what on earth? I mean, what on earth? And so it's been the same pattern every single game since we switched to three at the back, which is, you know, just defend the first half, try and build up some momentum, and then second half, like, really go for it. But
you're going to be missing Laurent Koscielny for the FA Cup final.
Well, this is the thing. And actually, as an aside, it's quite a testament to Wenger's been working on squad depth quite a lot. Arsenal have a very, very, very good squad depth. Is that they're missing their first three choice centre-backs, and they're going to have Rob Holding, who's been really good this season, Per Mertesacker, who's the club captain, good on form, and Nacho Monreal, who's looked pretty decent in the role. So it's not the end of the world, but obviously Laurent Koscielny missing is a bit of a blow. Also Mustafi, who when he came back into that back three looked really tidy. He seems very injury prone for a centre back. That's a bit worrying.
But on Mertesacker, he hasn't played much football.
No.
I think that was his first game of the season, wasn't it, on the last day.
I think it'll suit him very well, actually, the back three, because he's our best passer of the ball at
but
the back.
But Chelsea aren't going to...
And he can get two centre backs doing all his running for him. He'll just drop into that sweeper role, won't he?
I can
sweep
imagine
up
him
everything.
Just hugging the penalty area.
Yeah.
What if Diego Costa hugs him is what I'm trying to get at.
I mean, Mertesacker's the master of sort of, you know, he's under pressure. He's played a 25-yard pass straight to Santi Cazorla, you know. And the way Xhaka's playing at the moment in this 3-4-2-1 really suits. The main difference for me between the two teams is obviously personnel. There's very few of those Arsenal players that would get into the Chelsea lineup. Maybe Bellerin, maybe Sanchez, probably Sanchez.
Might try and make that reality.
I think they're going to try and make that reality. And also the fact that Chelsea have been playing with it basically all season. They look so comfortable, so solid. And defensively, you know, Arsenal can't really ask the questions. They don't have the answers to the questions that Chelsea's defence will pose. They'll be really, really solid at the back and very tricky to break down.
While there's a bit of uncertainty about Arsenal, Chelsea's going to pick themselves, aren't they, really?
Yeah, you'd think so. As Nick said, since they've made that switch, they've basically named the same team every week. Willian's been very good, so maybe Willian or Pedro would be the one you'd look at.
Willian did start in the FA semi-final.
Yeah, he scored twice. He was very, very good in that game, and he's been good the last few weeks. But otherwise, you'd say Chelsea basically picks itself. One thing I would say about if Mertesacker does play, I think considering he just hasn't played all year, he's going to need a lot of protection. And I think if Bellerin plays right wing back, he's just going to have to stick on Hazard, not really think about going forward that much, let Holding sort of deal with Costa, and then Mertesacker can just sort of sweep behind. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because if they leave him 1v1 against Costa, it's going to be dangerous for Arsenal.
And Marcus Alonso as well. That's what I've found quite fascinating about Chelsea. There's loads of points all over the team where you can go, oh, no one's quite seen how important this player is. But I really think Alonso and Hazard, That has just been a low-key, brilliant partnership.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Against at Stamford Bridge when Chelsea beat Arsenal. Arsenal were actually firmly in the game until Bellerin got knocked out. Obviously accidentally by Alonso, but he got knocked out and he had to be taken off. And after that, because Bellerin was in really good form at the time, Hazard and Alonso just ran riot down that right-hand flank. Their interplay is fantastic. Alonso's a really intelligent player. He's not the quickest, he's not the strongest. He's really, really clever, and he works well as a left wing-back.
Just looking at Arsenal's future...
Mysteries!
Yeah, pretty much. Wenger, apparently... I mean, this is going off some information that I think was posted on Reddit by someone who met Liam Brady in an airport, I think.
Boards.ie.
Board.ie. Apologies.
One of the lads had some crack with Liam Brady and
spelled C-R-A-I-C.
Yeah, not the other crack. Yeah.
Moorish.
Yeah, it's just such a mess, and it seems like for some reason or another, Wenger's not allowed to talk about it, or he won't talk about it.
Well, I don't think he would, because it sounds like there's an actual like boardroom dispute, and I guess you don't want that sort of getting to the public, do you?
You don't want to talk about it. It's probably all going to come out after the FA Cup final. The thing is, as well, is that Wenger's very diplomatic, and I don't think he ever really wants to throw anyone under the bus. Mm. I've only ever seen him once throw someone under the bus, and that was Mathieu Debuchy. Mathieu Debuchy was saying stuff about Wenger, and Wenger just went, "Nah, that's not true. You're making it up." The only time I can really remember him hanging someone out to dry. So I don't expect there to be many fireworks, but we'll know after the FA Cup final. It's a bit silly, really. He admitted himself that the uncertainty over his future has sort of led to them dropping out the top four, because they're comfortably good enough to come above Liverpool if you look at that squad.
But it's interesting that. Maybe it sounds like, given this, if this information is true,
yeah.
It sounds like maybe it wasn't up to him whether it was his decision.
Yeah, probably. He's probably. It sounds like his hands were tied, and it sounds like some impossible.
He's almost taken one for the team by saying, "Oh, it was me." But maybe it wasn't.
Well, if he's taken one for the team, then it's been that was a mistake, because they've ended up outside the top four. So, if he's playing politics, he's not playing it well enough, as intelligent as he is. And it's cost Arsenal. It may cost them for years to come, because Sanchez ain't going to stay around without Champions League football. Neither is Bellerin.
According to Chile, he already plays for Bayern Munich, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, those Chilean reports. So a bit of a mistake. Whatever Wenger has done, but I'm sure we'll find out in the weeks to come.
I remember reading something recently about how the board have just basically, I mean, everyone knows about Silent Stan, as the Arsenal fans refer to him. The Arsenal board have been so content letting Wenger do their talking for him that, eventually it must have been tough for him to just keep this facade up of not saying anything when there's so much to say.
He is a calm man.
Yeah, I know, but it was interesting, actually, after the last game of the season, he was very emotional. He doesn't really get like that often, so perhaps that's an indicator that this weekend will be his last game.
Going to move on now to our BetBot accumulator for the weekend ahead. It's pretty much cup final weekend across Europe. Yeah. And to get in the groove, we've got an accumulator for you that hits all the sweet spots. So first one is Paris Saint-Germain versus Angers in the French Cup final. We've got Paris Saint-Germain to win the first half at 1/2.
Which is ridiculous odds. PSG are a really good team. They're playing really well at the moment. Angers are really not great. The French Cup, Coupe de la France, interestingly, is like a competition where there's like literally amateur teams can enter it, so it's really good fun, and there's a million games. So Angers are going to be exhausted. PSG have a massive squad. Like it's a bit of a banker, and at 1/2, like
why not?
You look at the Coupe de la Ligue as well, when PSG were playing Monaco, full strength Monaco, aside from a couple of injuries, and they absolutely battered them. So yeah, I'd agree with Nick. That's pretty much a bank, you'd say.
Good cup team. PSG. You look at the sort of players they've got, good cup
team.
At
the manager they've got, good cup manager.
Yeah,
as well,
good cup manager, yeah.
Moving on to Spain, the home of Unai Emery. And Barcelona will be playing Alaves in the Copa del Rey final. We've got Barcelona down to win both halves, 4/7.
Again, We're doing these accas in partnership with BetBull, so we build the accas and we're using the stats. But like Barcelona are killing it at the moment. Like they're scoring. How many goals have they got in La Liga? Like 112.
They've got
or
the
something?
Most goals in Europe's top five leagues.
It's unbelievable. And Alaves, they're not exactly renowned for their defensive capacity. They've been really lucky to get through to the final. So I can't see anything other than Barcelona just steamrolling them. And hungry players as well. It'll be Luis Enrique's last game.
True, yeah.
So they'll be wanting to win it for him.
100%. Over in Germany, it could be Thomas Tuchel's last game, if you believe all the rumours about what's going on in Dortmund, and they'll be taking on Eintracht Frankfurt in the DFB Pokal Cup final. We've gone with over 1.5 goals at 40/85. Probably one for the decimal odds, that one.
Decimal?
Dortmund, young side, loads and loads of goals.
I think if there's one upset out of these games, discounting Arsenal-Chelsea, I think that's probably it.
Yeah,
Frankfurt have had a really good season, and they're capable of springing a surprise against Dortmund, I think, definitely.
Really efficient going up front, Eintracht Frankfurt. They get goals very easily, if that makes sense. They just move the ball nicely. They run into the channels very well. Goals. Neither team really renowned for their defending.
Well, Frankfurt's got this player back three quite well, haven't they? As you say. So maybe we'll come down to who can counter best. In Italy, Bologna host Juventus in the final weekend of fixtures in Serie A. Surprise, surprise, we've got Juventus to win at evens.
I just saw evens and I thought, I'm going to... Juventus to win at evens in Serie A.
Yeah.
Yep. Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks for that. And in the FA Cup final, as you've already been
I'm
over,
being really
Arsenal...
reductive, sorry, but it's just you see evens for Juve to win.
There's
anyway.
Not much more we can say, really. Our final and fifth part of the acca is Arsenal versus Chelsea in the FA Cup. Chelsea to score at 2/13.
Yeah, not amazing odds, but you back Chelsea to score. If you're going to put any bet on this game, is Arsenal, they always play the way they play. They always concede, especially when Lauren Koscielny...
Depleted defence as well.
Strange defence, haven't really played together. Per Mertesacker looks vulnerable. I know I was saying that his distribution's great and everything, but how slow is he going to be now? He's been out for a whole... Imagine how slow he's going to be. So if they go with a high line even for 10 minutes, Eden Hazard's going to be all over him.
Mertesacker and high line.
Mertesacker and high line. You know,
he's literally going to have to play as like a second goalkeeper, isn't he?
That could work.
On the post at all times.
Czech's not
lad.
The quickest either off his line. Mm. I mean, we've seen what he does when he runs. Yeah. Tweaked his hamstring, didn't he, last time he did it? So.
He did. Can't we have any of that? No, David Ospina in the final. Oh, we're going to go now to the final end of the podcast. Actually, if you do want to check out our accumulator, there is a link in the podcast description for you to check out the BetBall link. Follow us on there and join our accumulator or challenge us with your own. Do have a look into that. I'm now going to wrap up the podcast with a few philosophical questions that we've picked up this week and in the previous weeks from our fans. Daniel Gutman asks, what do you see as the future of the fullback position given the way modern flanking defenders are expected to bomb forward constantly? This goes back to what we're saying about Man City, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, I think we've seen that basically this season with teams switching to a back three and basically fullbacks being pushed into that wing-back role. Mm. I think that probably is the future for the next couple of years, is teams utilising different systems and making their fullbacks more integral to their attacking style of play, like at Spurs, like at Chelsea, like at Monaco as well, who have played a back four, but Fabinho and Bakayoko have basically just been sucked into the defence.
With their wingers tucking in as well to give them space as well.
So, yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, you know, fullbacks have been, the last 10 years, have been more inclined to go forward and less so defensively. And I think the way the game is going tactically, their defensive flaws won't be as sort of obvious or exploited. So perhaps that, the back three, I think, has sort of liberated them to an extent.
What I find quite interesting is... next season, let's say Pep brings in a player like Fabinho or Jonas Hector that can play midfield and fullback. Will we be seeing the inverted wingback come back into fashion? He's tried it twice now with Bayern and City. Yeah. Hasn't fully worked. He hasn't had the players. But maybe if he gets them, that could be an interesting way forward. And also, just a shout out to Tony Pulis, the man himself. I remember when he rocked up at Stamford Bridge to face Chelsea this season, he played a back five. But with inverted fullbacks, in the sense that he had the guy with the left foot was on the right, the guy with the right foot was on the left. And it actually snuffed out Chelsea's attack really well for the vast majority of the game. I think they had one chance, one goal. So maybe there's always a counter trend in tactics, so maybe that'll be the way it goes.
Yeah, that was a really clever move, by the way, because what it allowed to do is the fullbacks, a right foot fullback on the left bank, at left back, would sort of cover the pass inside and make sure that didn't happen. And then if you had to push out and cover that pass and the winger went down the wing, one member of the back three would go off and tackle them. Yeah. It was really impossible to get past. It was a very smart move.
Mm-hmm. Just showing them exactly the wrong way they wanted to go every single time. Nick, one for you, I think. Matt Brownie Cake asks, is the number 10 role no longer a position in the modern day Premier League? If so, do these players go where they should in the middle or in the hole, or should they change their game up?
So it depends on how you're defining the number 10. So if we're talking about...
Well, it always does, doesn't it?
Well, exactly. So, you know, there was... So a lot of the football hipsters... I'm doing inverted commas with my fingers. I always do that. The number 10 position has been evolving over the past couple of years, you know, with players like... Probably players like Ozil, who's very much like what you describe as a modern number 10. That sort of modern number 10 role seems to be being redefined as false eights, whatever it might be. But to my mind, you know, that number 10 is basically, do you have a player in an advanced midfield position who's basically just allowed to roam and basically do whatever he wants and just create as much, you know? And that sort of role would apply to players like Antoine Griezmann at Atletico Madrid, who's you know, absolutely. I was actually at the last game with the Vicente Calderon last week. It was unbelievable. And, you know, you just watch him drift around the pitch. He was everywhere, just creating at will. So I think it really depends on the manager. I think it does exist as a position. It doesn't really have a definition anymore because we haven't got players like Riquelme or Zidane who are very much sticking to a space between the lines of midfield and defence, because tactically the game's evolved from that. There's no longer that space. So it's hard to put a definition on the position of number 10.
I think it'll be difficult to see a player, like Nick was saying, like Riquelme, just given that licence to just sort of roam around the pitch in that area, not really contribute defensively. Mm. I don't think we're really going to see that in the Premier League anymore. I'm going to use a couple of examples. You look at Spurs with Eriksen. He sort of plays this like hard-working playmaker type role where he drifts around, but he presses.
I've seen people describe him as a defensive playmaker. It's quite an apt way of putting it.
Exactly. And then City as well. I mean, De Bruyne and Silva are what you describe as classic number 10s, but they play central midfield now. And they play three wingers, well, two wingers and a striker up front. And those guys have dropped into a midfield three.
They've kind of vacated the area where the 10 would be, so that anyone could be the 10 at any given time. It's quite strange, isn't it?
I think the way tactics are going, you're not going to get someone who's just literally going to sit there. Maybe Griezmann as a second striker, but I'd say that's a different sort of role to a number 10.
He almost subverts what the 10 does, because rather than using that awareness of space to get the ball and ping it on somebody else, he's there to, almost like how Muller does it in some ways. I'm not saying they're similar players, but bear with me here. But in the way that his awareness of space allows him to drop into places to receive the ball to shoot rather than to create.
And further up the pitch as well. He wouldn't necessarily drop into that role just outside the area. He'd be looking to get into the area off a striker or off a winger. So, I think it's maybe not as we have sort of thought of a number 10.
Maybe it's not so much a position, it's more a space on the pitch which you can attack in various ways.
It's a state of mind.
Carlos Salvador asks, what are the top five games from around Europe you've seen this season?
What a name. Well, Barca PSG. Let's just get that one.
Which one?
Well, second leg, obviously. It was remarkable. I was just looking
at Real Madrid.
Barca Real Madrid
was ridiculous.
Awesome. Oh my God.
What about RB Leipzig versus Bayern Munich?
Yeah, I was about to say the first game where Bayern Munich just went, oh, you're the young upstart, top of the league. No. And just absolutely battered them for 90 minutes. It was great to watch. I love a fairy tale being ruined.
The second game was even more like that. Bayern had already won the title.
Yeah.
Leipzig went, 4-2 up, was it?
Yeah.
And then with 5 minutes left, Bayern were like, nah, we're not having this. We're going to reel you back in and show that we're still the big dogs here.
I thought the...
I think Monaco versus Man City needs a shout.
Oh my God, yes. What a game. The first leg of that was incredible.
Both games.
Yeah, the first leg was incredible.
Barcelona versus Man City at Man City as well.
Yeah, and the first Man City versus Man United game, where it was like, oh my God, Pep Guardiola's arrived. That was as complete a performance you'll see from a team. That was incredible.
And then they both proved to be frauds.
Yeah, exactly.
Ajax Lyon was a lot of fun as well.
Ajax Lyon was great fun. Any Liverpool game from that run where they just battered everyone, they were so good to watch.
I think Chelsea, for me, have been involved in the Premier League, have been involved in more fun games than any others, because it's because they know how to defend in a way that's actually quite satisfying to watch. So even when they're playing an attacking team, they often kind of bounce off each other in a way you go, that's really good football.
Yeah, yeah. The Chelsea-Liverpool game actually was really good. Liverpool played brilliantly and David Luiz scored an absolute worldie. That was good fun to watch.
Spurs versus City as well. That needs a shout.
Yeah,
Spurs-Chelsea
was great. So much good football this
Carlos,
year.
Carlos, we've given you more than five. Yeah, exactly. But,
enjoy.
Enjoy indeed. Another question from Leslie Wilson-Assam, who asks, I think this is tied into the fact that Xabi Alonso, Philippe Lahm have retired. Five footballers current and retired who look fit to be future managers. He calls Xabi Alonso. Looking to forward to hear ours.
So I'm going to totally sidestep the question and make the point that there's not many. Greg's rolling his eyes at me. Totally sidestep the question, because the reason there's so many managers right now that are ex-players is, I think, because the money involved in the game where they were players is nowhere near like it is now. There's no need for... being a manager is a really stressful job, a lot of responsibility, a lot of limelight. Not everyone is cut out for it as we...
Not everyone could be Steve Bruce.
Exactly. Not everyone could be Dean Saunders. So I think there'll be a lot fewer of current players in terms of ratio that go on to be managers. I think there'll be a lot lower. A lot more players doing what the Rios, the Owen Hargreaves are doing, which is basically just doing media work because it's really well paid. It's super chill. You don't really have to do a lot. Yeah, Gary Neville's probably agreeing with me right now somewhere. In terms of actual players who've gone to be good managers...
Ah, we're on to the question now. Go on.
Ah, yes. We're answering the question. Ah. I think for you love him, hate him, whatever you might think of him, I think John Terry is definitely going to be a manager. He's one of those guys who, whether it's true or not, acts as if he's got a football instead of a heart. You know, that's how he rolls. I think he'd probably do a good job because he's a natural born leader and he seems to be quite the diplomat.
I've always thought of him as like Lampard's number two.
Yeah.
The enforcer kind of assistant manager bloke, personally.
I'd like to see a Terry Lamps duo. I would like to see Ashley Cole as a manager. I know that sounds really, really weird, but I think he's like one of the most intelligent. Ollie's looking at me like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, that's come out of left forgotten field.
That's come out of left field, left back. I think, okay, let me explain this. Ashley Cole's probably the most intelligent footballer England's ever had, right? I would like to say.
This is a big shout to bring on at the end of the pod.
Do you want to edit it out? Because it's a total nonsense. Just put edit in, I'll edit it out.
Nah. Who would you pick, Ollie?
Kind of boring, maybe. Mikel Arteta, I think, would be a good manager.
Oh, yeah, he's well
obviously
on
working
way.
With Pep. Yeah. Have we seen any Pep sort of disciples?
Pep prodigies?
Tito obviously was really good at Barca. Yeah. But I think Mikel Arteta, I think, learning from basically his last year at Arsenal, he wasn't really playing. He was like a non-playing captain at Arsenal. He's always lauded as like a, you know, really inspirational, good guy. I think he'd be a good manager.
Xavi.
Yeah. Manuel Neuer, I reckon, would be good.
I was about to say Petr Cech.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems like he's got that statesman-like thing. I see him more like going into an organisational role at FIFA.
The Edwin van der Sar-esque thing. Yes. Maybe that's a smart, intelligent goalkeeper thing to do.
Yeah, basically any Dutch player, any good Dutch player.
Yeah.
You know, except Van der Vaart, who's
mental. Well, this is the thing. Like, those guys like Cuckoo and...
Cuckoo!
And Giovanni van Bronckhorst.
So many of that Dutch team have gone into management.
Yeah,
it's
and
mental.
They definitely didn't lack money because they all came through the Bosnian era, didn't they? So
It's so the thing of, like, you need... This is kind of why I was going down the Ashley Cole route, to be fair, is that you need a special combination of arrogance and intelligence to be a manager. Like, you look at all the managers now, they're all a bit arrogant, they're all a bit...
I really can't see Ashley Cole though. I'm really sorry.
He probably wouldn't go to it. I think he'd do a really good job rather than anything else, because he's good at the camera. I'm gonna stop. You're looking at me with so much disrespect.
We need more goalkeeper turned managers. I think
I'd like to see Neuer
or Buffon.
Yes.
Buffon.
Lloris in 10 years time.
Lloris.
Lloris going back to Nice.
Rushing out of his dugout. Yeah. No, Lloris, no! It's the wrong area! We're going to move on now to Neymar is Brazil asks. It's not Neymar, it's a fan account. Yeah. Should Neymar think about going to Manchester City? And what striker should Milan sign?
No. Why would Neymar go to City?
In terms of strikers for Milan, Morata has been linked.
Why would Morata go to Milan?
Is your answer to these questions just going to be the same?
Yeah, it is. It is. I've dodged every question somewhere or other.
Ollie, can you give us some substance, please, mate?
Belotti.
Belotti's a good shout. Ooh,
yeah. If they've got loads of money, it would be a step up for Belotti. Everyone wants Milan to be good again. So just spend the money, get someone good. Belotti is the one.
Bunga, bunga. Moving on now to Crippy Cook. He asks, will Sunderland be regretting banking on Moyes given he's just jumped ship after 1 year into a four-year deal? Or should they have sacked him anyway going into the championship?
It was just like a horrible marriage of just a club going nowhere and a manager going nowhere. That it was always just going to end in this like disaster of relegation. Sunderland.
In many ways, David Moyes and Sunderland were absolutely perfect for each other. Just two people resigned to their fate. Resigned to, we're not going anywhere, are we? We're not.
David Moyes has had a bad year in many ways, not only the whole kind of comment to the female reporter and not showing himself in a good light, but the guy needs a rest. I feel sorry for him at this point in terms of a football sense.
Likewise. Like, I mean, he just...
United knocked him for six, and he looks like a guy who hasn't slept. And it's just like, oh, he's old Gil off the Simpsons. Oh, yeah, this next deal is going to set me up. No, no, David.
This next job is going to take me to the Champions League.
Exactly. No, David, have some time off. Go and live with your family for a bit. Just stop.
He's got the money.
He's been sacked enough times, but he's just...
He's still living off redundancy packages.
He's still got 2 years left on his United deal, hasn't he? He's still going.
Yeah, that was a six-year deal, wasn't it?
Maybe or... like a curse type thing. Once that contract is over, then he will finally remember how to manage or something. I don't know.
Maybe. He's a decent manager. I mean, he probably the best thing for him to do would just be to go in the championship, stay out of the limelight, manage the team. He'd probably command a still quite a decent wage there.
Maybe he should go out of management until all the players that he coached at Everton have retired so he can't sign them again, and then come back into it with a fresh set of eyes.
But with them as coaching staff.
Oh, here we go.
Lescott, coaching staff. Hibbert, coaching staff.
Phil Neville, director of football. Final question, going to end on a high. Paul Ansonge asks, when did you fall in love with football and why?
And why?
You can't dodge this one.
Yeah, no. We're not supposed to be like partisan on this pod, but probably the first time I went to Highbury to watch an Arsenal game when I was 5. And I was just like, oh my God. Like, you know, it sounds silly, but the buzz of like 35,000 people not making any noise would be the obvious joke to make here. But, you know, shouting and screaming and, you know, saying words that I didn't understand, which I later found out were swear words.
Wenger out.
you know, still George Graham at the time. That was amazing, and it's impossible not to fall in love with it. Quick aside story is that initially when I was about 4, apparently, I don't remember this, but someone asked me, oh, who do you support? And I went, Chelsea, because I just like the colour blue. I really like the colour blue. And my sister, who's quite a bit older than me, just turned around and went, nah, you support Arsenal. Yeah.
That's her voice.
Yeah, that's her voice, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Ollie, when did you fall in love with football and why?
I don't know if I can pinpoint an exact moment, but the first tournament I remember watching was the 98 World Cup. And I was just like, this is awesome. This is great. The whole tournament was class. It was filled with so many sort of cult players, like peak Ronaldo, when he had those R9 boots and that advert, the Nike advert in the airport. That was class.
Oh, that was good. Bobby Carlos. Yeah. Nilsson.
Michael Owen sort of exploding onto the scene in that game.
Goal.
Yeah, yeah. Just that tournament, I think, probably looking back, was the one where I was like, yeah, football is the one. Football's better than Star Wars. I'm going to stick with this.
I think Euro 96 had a similar effect on me. Yeah. But
yes.
The only thing I remember about that is Seaman save from McAllister. That's the only thing.
Well, and going straight up the other pitch and Gazza lobbing Hendry and rifling it in. Dentist chair.
I think there was a little bit of me thinking like, is this what always happens in a game of football? I'd been to a lot of games actually at matches as a kid, but I remember after Euro 96, I don't know how, but I just didn't realise there was such a thing as European football. And I sat down and went, to my mum and dad, like, it wouldn't it be good if they did this but with like teams? And they were like, yeah, it's called the Champions League. I was like, great, let's watch it. That'll do for me.
It began.
And then it began. Wonderful times. But that's all we've got time for today on the Squawker Talker podcast. Interesting matches ahead in the weekend, FA Cup, all the rest of it. Nick, it's been great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a laugh. It's very warm in this room, but I've enjoyed...
Summer has arrived and it's got a bit tropical, hasn't it?
I've enjoyed every minute.
Ollie, how are you holding up?
I'm struggling now. I feel like I'm burning.
Ollie is very red right now.
You actually are.
I'm really red.
I feel like I'm in the oven.
I can see the air.
Yeah. That's not air. You think that's air you're breathing?
Oh, no. Anyway, that's like I said, it's probably for the best that we end it there. So thanks for listening and see you on Tuesday. It is Bank Holiday Monday, so we'll be back a little bit later next week. But see you then.